to my illustrious family and friends near and far, old and new. This is Kevin Mercurio on the mic, and welcome to the 23rd episode of the Metaforgeons podcast. Now, to show support if you like this sort of content, please make sure to rate and subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or Google Podcasts or whatever platform you're listening to this on. And follow at Metaforgeons on Instagram. That's at Metaforgeons. I'll be posting most of my updates as well as on my personal website, kjbmercurio.com/Metaforgeons. Again, I will hold another draw on my 30th episode for the gorgeous butterfly printed custom Metaforgeons shirt. So remember to follow the Instagram page to be placed into the draw. Okay. So for today's episode, I'm going to discuss a relatively recent expression that took the internet by storm, memeing its way from Jolly Saint and expressions nice to naughty list. Let's boot up the story's environment. You are a man. Yes, we can happily discuss how much easier it has become for you to rise up the company ladder, how family doesn't seem to berate you with questions about marrying a partner, and how you're suddenly described by dominant characteristics. We will save these topics for another day. You see, you have a major problem on your hands, or rather, in between your legs. It was Valentine's Day yesterday, and you and your partner were getting frisky like it was a duo scene from 1979's Caligula. Pants were dropped, drink glasses were toppled, limbs were flying. There may have been guest musical appearances by Barry White and Madonna. It was an epic endeavor. To extend the pleasure, in more ways than one, you decide to take a performance enhancer, the almighty blue pill. "Are you sure about this?" your partner asked worriedly. "Of course I am. You know, Neo was wrong all along. Why not take the blue pill and continue living in bliss?" "I know, typical men, right?" Anyway, this leads to a full-scale circus bonanza. Hey-o! Passion and love, sweat and a little bit of tears filled the bedroom for just over 4 hours. Out of breath and ready for bed, you both lie on the bed, facing up at the ceiling. "So," your partner starts, "it's, still standing. I mean, it's become more like the Tower of Pisa, but still, what a wonder of this world." "Yeah," you hesitantly agree, "but it's starting to feel a bit numb. It is past 4 hours. I think we should call our doctor. Do you think he's up tonight?" "He's a stiff chap, rude as an asshole after spicy Saturdays at fiestas. I'm certain he's working right now on some paperwork. Let me give him a call." You call your doctor and he tells you to meet him at his clinic right away. You put on your pants and your sweatpants and throw on a sweatshirt and some sneakers. Penguin straddling down the driveway to your car, you start the engine and drive to the clinic. Luckily, the lights are already on and you meet your doctor inside with a smile on his face.
"Well, look at you," your doctor says. "Seems like you've seen better days. You look like the version Pinocchio Walt Disney wanted to make."
"All right, all right. Can you help me out or not?" you ask.
"Hold your horses there, Seabiscuit," your doctor says. "You might not like the steps we take from here. You see, I have to see whether you have low or high blood flow to that medieval cannon."
By then, your doctor already reached into the cabinet beside the patient table and took a needle and syringe. Before you know it, it's already happening.
"Happy frickin' Valentine's Day," you say painfully under your breath.
"You too, honey," your doctor laughs.
"Good news, though. It's bright red. That means you have high blood flow. We don't need to be afraid of tissue damage to the vertical mushroom cloud, okay, Moab? Now, the best thing to do here is to just relax. Take some ice cubes, throw them in a nice baggie, plop yourself on the couch, watch Netflix and chill it."
"That's it? No drugs or anything?"
"I think you've had enough drugs for today, my dingo. Now get the hell out of here."
You roll your eyes, questioning why you continue to be a patient of Dr. Douchebag, but you head back home and tell your partner what the doctor advised.
"So he just said to watch Netflix and chill?"
your partner asks, confused.
"Yeah," you say. "Something about high blood flow means no tissue damage, atomic bombs, Pinocchio. I don't know.
He seemed to not be worried, so I guess we shouldn't be either." Your partner hurries to the kitchen to put together an ice cube bag while you walk to the living room couch like a real-life stick figure. Your partner joins you and hands you the bag of ice. You place it on the base.
Cold!
Your partner boots up the smart TV and scrolls to Netflix.
On the main page, you both browse the most trending movies and shows in your country. Sex Education, Below Her Mouth, Gypsy, Game of Thrones, My Days of Mercy, Sense8, Nymphomaniac, Orange is the New Black, Black Mirror, Spring Breakers, The Vampire Diaries, Magic Mike, 50 Shades, The Trilogy. You and your partner look at each other, and in the heat of reading out sexualized words out loud, began World Love 3. Pants dropped to the ground, ice cubes toppled, limbs flying in each and every direction. Passion and love, sweat, and even more tears filled the living room for just 2 episodes of Orange is the New Black. Out of breath and quite ready for bed, you both sit up on the couch facing the TV screen. On it, Netflix's shameless prompt, "Are you still watching?" is taped on a black translucent screen.
"Wow, that last one worked," your partner musters up the strength to break the silence. You look at now deflated balloon animal. "You're right, it did. Maybe Dr. Douchebag really does know what he's talking about."
You grab your phone and dial up the doctor again.
"Why the hell are you still calling me at this hour?"
your doctor yells into the phone. "You were right, Doc. Netflix and chill really did the trick." You laugh and hang up on his rude ass.
All right, the tension is over. Let's erect our heads out of the gutter.
Get. Although this expression easily serves as an excuse for some lowbrow humor, its origin story is certainly one that's not well known. Ubiquitous in modern culture, how did a streaming service get bent and holed in with coitus? What's the origin to the expression Netflix and chill?
Most of this information was obtained from various articles discussing the origin and influence of this expression. All sources we mentioned in the description. I want to pause for a second and ask you the following question. Can you name a saying or concept that took the internet by storm recently, say, within the last year? Perhaps the most recent one that comes to mind is Chairman Bernie. A still image of Senator Bernie Sanders sitting during Joseph R. Biden's inauguration with some cozy mittens. This prompted thousands of memes photoshopping the senator sitting in various pop culture references. To my fellow academics, remember Wormageddon? I mean, sure, all of these trended for a brief period of time, but they weren't overly attached girlfriend big, or ain't nobody got time for that versatile. At least not yet. There are plenty of examples out there of memes highlighting slip-ups, genuine candids, or stills of moments captioned with something so relatable. What about sayings? Like Futurama's, "I don't want to live on this planet anymore." Or that overused motivational piece of, "Keep calm and carry on." Now what about euphemisms? The Karen concept, Instagram thoughts, and Twitch's Pogger emote. There lies the interesting story of today's expression, Netflix and chill, an initially innocuous one turned sexual innuendo exploding on the interwebs. All right, I'll stop with the undertones. Researching this idea was full of gaffes that literally made me laugh out loud. How did articles describe its evolution in mainstream? One article featured in Shape mentions that, quote, "The year 2015 was a main turning point for the phrase. In April, it was added to the notorious Urban Dictionary, the site where users can make their own additions to the formation of the modern-day youth lexicon, defined as code for two people going to each other's houses and having sexual intercourse or doing other sexual-related acts." Funny in itself, until I realized that this Shape article was written by a dog named Pebble. Netflix and chill is one of those ideas that came from something innocent and has now grown into something of modern cultural lore. Its influence has affected thousands, if not millions, of teenagers in North America and around the world. It's so influential, in fact, that it has appeared in major news sites like The Guardian and The New York Times. Additionally, its influence on culture doesn't stop there. There's a 2017 horror comedy hosting its name that was selected to be featured in the Netherlands Film Festival. The now-known Flat Earth believer and rapper B.O.B. created a song called Netflix and Chill featuring World and London. Nordstrom has a line of clothing suited for those engaging in the literal meaning. Mind you, it ain't cheap.
Hell, even Ben and Jerry's jumped on the trend with their peanut butter fudge dotted with pretzels flavor, Netflix and chilled. You don't see Karen's getting their ice cream flavor now, do you? In fairness, some offended person would probably sue. Netflix and chill became a Halloween costume, a night on the town starter kit, an inside joke boomers wouldn't understand until a year later. Even Netflix themselves, either without PR advice or succumbing to the internet sensation, did a bit of tongue-in-cheek advertising. In an article on Mank Union by Rowan Jenner, Netflix posted, quote, "a gift from Clueless," revealing Cher Horowitz's honorable attempt to seduce her high school crush whilst watching a movie, with the caption, "Netflix and chill? No, really." The Netflix Switch, debuting in the 2015 World Maker Faire, involving a do-it-yourself project, creating a button that when pressed, automatically dims the lights, puts your phone on Do Not Disturb, and turns on the Netflix service on your smart TV, was easily relabeled by the unforgiving internet as the, quote, "Netflix and Chill Switch." But come on, Kev, let's bring in this tangent back to the podcast purpose, the origin of Netflix and Chill. Well, technically, there are two origins. In a wonderful article posted in Splinter, previously Fusion, by Kevin Roos, goes deep in the life of the term. Goodyear, you caught that one. Let's begin with the innocent saying. Netflix themselves have been operating since 1997 as a mail-order DVD internet company that transitioned to membership streaming on 2007. Fun fact, the company in its early days of the transition had a rule called the Canadian Principle, in which prevented the company from expanding to the Canadian market due to difficulties in handling different currencies. Canada was given access in 2010, and other countries followed suit thereafter. The first recorded use is a tweet by the account @NoFaceNita on January 22, 2009. Yes, the research on this expression is super accurate, that stated, quote, "I'm about to log on to Netflix and chill for the rest of the night." In early 2014, 5 years later, still, people were using it in its literal form. However, the phrase Netflix and chill became a standalone activity. Rather than having to say, I'm going to watch Netflix and chill on my couch, it became completely unnecessary to mention any context whatsoever. Then, all of a sudden, in late summer of that year, Twitter users began including emojis that insinuated something far more than just a session of Netflix and chill. And in later months, the word chill began to appear in scare quotes, popularized on Black Twitter, other online communities on the platform, and other internet groups rode the trending train, like Vine user Brittany Ferlin, whose Netflix and chill video was watched 11 million times in just a few months. Its confirmation on Urban Dictionary later that year solidified its placement as a cultural meme. A somewhat crude and explicit segment, I realize. But it's interesting how concepts catch on in such a diverse and connected world. Something so literally common as watching Netflix became the mating call for many individuals even to this day. Memes, like concepts from its origins of evolutionary biology, really do appear randomly and stick if enough minds relate to it, vibe with it. Netflix and chill replaces its predecessors knocking boots, do the Humpty Hump, bump uglies, and smush. However, perhaps by focusing on one euphemism, we lose that historical context that once had so much meaning, so much relatability. I end with the late 19th century version of our beloved innuendo that may boink the minds of my fellow content creators. Quote, "Would you like to come up and see my etchings?" Before we get to the next segment, do you love listening to podcasts? If you're like myself, you may have contemplated even starting a podcast yourself. Let me tell you, as one of the many ways one can creatively express themselves, starting this podcast was one of the best decisions I have ever made. For one thing, it sort of gives you an excuse to learn about things you actually are interested in and understand it by speaking to an audience about it. For another, it has given me the opportunity to meet other podcasters and other science communicators who inspire me in their own creative endeavors. The problem in starting something new is that it may be difficult to know where to start. That's where Buzzsprout comes in.
Buzzsprout is a seamless service that helps one launch a professional podcast with over 100,000 people supported on their platform. Your show can be online and listed in all the major podcast directories like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more within minutes of finishing your recording. Additionally, you get a sweet-looking podcast website, detailed analytics to support the growth of your show, by far the greatest feature, methods of promoting and marketing your show, the list goes on. And of course, the Buzzsprout community of experts and podcast hosts offers great tips via online forums, YouTube videos, and even quick podcast episodes themselves. To start your own podcast and get a $20 Amazon gift card you can use towards simple podcast equipment you may need, click the affiliate link in the episode's description. This lets Buzzsprout know that I sent you to their service and will help support MetaForigins in money towards creating more butterfly merch. Buzzsprout, the easiest way to start a podcast. And now, back to the episode. For my communication segment, I would like to talk about an activity that has risen in popularity by the recent events of, a deadly coronavirus bringing the world to its mercy over the past year. An activity that I have dipped my toes into and actually do see some benefits, and that topic is virtual dating. How many of us have turned to the interwebs in search for some companionship during a time when distance is not only mandatory, but also logical? I mean, there's plenty of applications out there. Tinder, Hinge, OkCupid, Plenty of Fish, Two, Bumble, Coffee Meets Bagel. For those part of the LGBTQ community, there's Grindr, Hurt, Glimmer, Thirst. For those who like to date on their computers instead of their phones, there's eHarmony, Christian Mingle, Match, Zoosk. Hell, Facebook Dating became a service in 2019. What about classified ads? And to my fellow Ottawa residents, there's always Ashley Madison. I say that only because an update by the Toronto-based service stated that in 2015, 1 in 5 Ottawa residents were users of the, quote, website created for married people to find new lovers. We were, prior to this, popularizing a dating game like drive-through fast food. And no, the pandemic didn't seem to help those living alone. And no, the pandemic didn't seem to vibe well with singles who know that their relatives and their friends have the underrated opportunity for physical contact. And yes, that includes sexual physicality, but it doesn't have to. A handshake, a hug, a pat on the back for making a meal using little ingredients because grocery stores are high-risk contact zones. In a PBS article lamenting what dating is like in pandemic times, one 40-year-old man declared, quote, "It almost felt like dating in the Elizabethan era," Price said. "If I could get, like, one little fingertip in between her shoulder blades through a parka, that was like the most exciting thing I've had in a month." The existence of these applications were obviously extremely popular before the pandemic. But now, what happens when we eliminate the quick meetup for more substance? Sure, isolated and socially distanced, people are thumb swiping like windshield wipers on a rainy day. That sort of behavior can be argued as unchanging. Reports at the start of last summer from one service, OkCupid, found a 700% increase in virtual dating. Zoom dates became a thing. FaceTime calling was used in first dates likely as much as calls to check up on a family member. Apps integrated video and audio calling features so as to encourage meeting virtually. Even Bumble CEO Whitney Wolf Heard published a letter and issued an in-app notification that supported the virtual dating trend. Mainstream news sites offer countless top 10 lists from Forbes Dating Tips to NBC's COVID Dating Shopping Guide, the number one item on the latter list being a forehead thermometer. For yourself, not for your date. Imagine pulling out one of these for a temperature check on your prospective partner. Everyone on the online dating space jumped on this trend in support of government guidelines. And how did users adapt to this new culture? Who would have thought that a 2017 McGill University study of the psychological impact of infectious disease risk in dating would be relevant today? In said study, researchers found that those more prone to disease displayed lower interest in prospective dates, a kind of survival instinct given the term, quote, behavioral immune system. This mechanism has definitely made its appearance even in those who aren't more vulnerable, as the rational way of dating these days. Moreover, a recent survey by Singles in America of 5,000 Americans showed that 63% of those surveyed are spending more time getting to know matched partners, and 58% shifted towards the mentality with the intention to date, as opposed to browsing or DTF, I presume. Interestingly, and perhaps this may be an American statistic only, but 76% of those surveyed believe it's important that potential partners share the same political beliefs. In the growing polarized world we find ourselves in today, this comes as little surprise. Yet, I wonder how Canadians fare in this metric. I say that coming from a family of four in which each of us voted for a different party in the last federal election, but I guess we're stuck together anyway. Even how we present ourselves changed. In an Atlantic article about social distance dating, Dr. Sarah Conrath writes, quote, "I've seen more signals of kindness on men's profiles since the pandemic. Sometimes the clues are less obvious, such as one man who wore an American Red Cross shirt, but sometimes people directly mention their favorite charitable causes." Melissa Hobley, a chief marketing officer at OkCupid, quote, found that from the spring into the fall, the presence of terms such as caring, compassionate, and empathetic increased 3% on OkCupid profiles, along with a 5% increase in mentions of volunteer. More dramatic, mentions of donate and donating increased 29% from April to June and another 10% from October to November. People may be prioritizing giving because of the pandemic or the national reckoning on racism, but being charitable also may have a nice side effect when it comes to dating. And oddly enough, studies have demonstrated that people rate those who give to causes as more physically attractive. Again, we see that we've adapted. Quoting a 2020 article published in CTV News, quote, "Small talk is out, old-fashioned courting is in, the pandemic has shifted the dating game. Very little would risk viral infection while neglect the comfort of their snuggies and wool socks with a virtual someone who seems anthropomorphic at best or an Olympic speed thumb typist. It became all about substance. It became all about working towards asking the question, hey, do you want to breathe the air in my bubble?" But with said adaptation comes introspective realization. Even for myself, I see opportunities of romance through chatting between matches, but in the end, what am I and others expecting to achieve? In an article published in Time, writer Reza Bruner speaks about, quote, "the forever online boyfriends of the pandemic, or matches that share the struggles brought about by SARS-CoV-2. Family issues, job uncertainties, financial turmoil, all shared with complete strangers Bruner hasn't met and may likely never meet, quote, "but maybe he and every other one of these internet boyfriends will eventually fade out of my life, their purpose served. I'm grateful for them anyway." In an article published in Vox, writer Elizabeth Segrin argues that, quote, "COVID-19 has made dating harder and more laborious than it was before. Since being single in society has both a status and biological impression," Segrin states, quote, "for many, the anxiety is wrapped up in the idea that there is an ideal age to get married, somewhere between their late 20s and early 30s, and they're now in danger of missing the window due to the pandemic. Perhaps we don't want to escalate to the epiphany that host of a single-serving podcast, Shani Silver, had, quote, "then coronavirus came, and now I just want a fucking husband." We find ourselves in an interesting paradox, if you will. While we are adapting to substance-heavy human rapport, we also seem to increase negative feelings of anxiety and loneliness, one being that we are single and being prevented from changing that, while the other being that with current matches come physical hindrances we may or may not choose to break. Writing this and speaking about it now is somehow both hopeful and depressing. And personally, these words you're hearing right now coming from a single man who recently ended a long-term relationship due to troubles exacerbated by the pandemic, among other things, I say this with genuine concern. But perhaps there's a missing opportunity no news article has mentioned, something that could be occurring with online dating, a skill that could be developed in parallel to the thumb swiping and keyboard typing and conversation skills in the art of human connection, or even as far as seduction, a lost love for oneself, the self-confidence that we are who we are now and will be after the pandemic. A super-liked match, underdog, limited only by what we think we are. Perhaps this is the time to use what makes us feel like a customer's value meal midnight drive-thru regret and grow into what we desire in prospective partners, place our interests and tenacity above all else. Perhaps, since the dating game is changing, perhaps we should ask ourselves, What can I change to match with myself? For today's episode, I'll be interviewing a good friend of mine I've known for quite some time, someone who not only has a high standing within the academic community, but also someone whose opinion I respect about the topic at hand. She's currently a graduate student in the Master of Arts in Criminology program at the University of Ottawa. Previously, she obtained an undergraduate degree in Criminology and Anthropology, also at the University of Ottawa. In 2017, following the completion of a paralegal diploma at Algonquin College, she received her paralegal license from the Law Society of Ontario. Her research interests include official misconduct, youth gang desistance, and access to information for Indigenous peoples living in rural and remote communities. Please welcome the dangerously ethical Eilish McNamara.
Cool. So, thank you, Eilish, for joining me on this episode today. This should be a pretty interesting episode, mainly because it's not like what I usually do. So, I normally talk about science communication topics or just like language in general. But because of the whole situation happening in the world, obviously in terms of COVID, This sort of topic is of interest to me, and I would assume it's of interest to you, so this should be a nice conversation, because we normally talk about this anyway, at like a restaurant or bar or something.
Tequila Tuesdays.
Tequila Tuesdays. Oh, yeah, we were supposed to have tequila, but that didn't, I don't have any. I have a coffee.
Why are you drinking coffee at this time?
Because I woke up very early today. Early to me is 7, though, so I don't know how early you wake up.
It's not that early.
I know.
Deadpan.
But, yeah, thank you again. And just so the listeners, you know, at home or in their car or doing their exercise, whatever they're doing during this podcast episode, just so they know, like who you are and how we know each other. We've known each other for just, like, maybe a couple of years or something like that. No, I'm joking. I've known you for quite a long time. But currently, you're a Master of Arts student in Criminology at the University of Ottawa, and you did an undergraduate degree in Criminology and Anthropology, which might actually be relevant to our discussion today. You also did some paralegal training, and of relevance is that you use different virtual online dating platforms. And that's why I wanted to talk to you today. But maybe you can just give like a just to everybody listening, just a brief experience on your work in academia, so like your Bachelor of Arts and the work you're currently doing now.
Yeah, so right now I'm doing my MA, and my thesis topic is on wrongful conviction, but I'm focusing on prosecutorial misconduct in New Orleans. But I'm using like a state crime framework to analyze the issue. So I'm looking to hope fully finish that by the end of this semester in April. And I currently work for the federal government, where we offer informational resources to victims of federal offenders. But I also currently work with a volunteer organization, Innocence Ottawa, where we do case file review for offenders that are currently incarcerated or have been paroled. And they're looking at potentially filing a 696 application, which is to review for wrongful conviction. So that's what I do with my spare time.
That sounds like a lot of work.
All work, no play.
While I was waiting to figure out which platform we were going to use, I was looking at Innocence Ottawa, like on their fact sheets, I guess. And Like, I read that since 1959, research has shown that there were 71 wrongful convictions, I guess, in Canada, I assume. And I guess the false positive rate is 0.5 to 1% of all serious convictions. To me, that sounds low, but, like, maybe you can elaborate on, do you think that's, obviously it should be zero, but is that a high number? Is that a low number?
That's basically an estimation. So right now, I would say generally in North America, the actual number of wrongful convictions is unknown right now, because usually when wrongful convictions happen, it goes unnoticed for many years until someone actually does a deep dive into the case. But like you said, I think it appears like a low number, but when people are trying to say the justice system is without flaw, it should be zero. But in reality, if any type of wrongful conviction or miscarriage of justice happens, it shouldn't be, and it's a problem.
I mean, the whole legal system is based off of creations of that humans have done, and humans are flawed in their own way. So I don't think it can ever be zero. We should strive for 0%, but 0.5 to 1%. So in terms of murders, that would be like one wrongfully convicted person of murder for every 100 murders in Canada, I guess, right?
Yeah, but in the States, I think that's where the numbers are like driven up even higher. Their rates of wrongful conviction, because they calculate it by 100,000. So the numbers would be quite high. I mean, with my research personally, there's in Louisiana, there's been 65 wrongful convictions. And in New Orleans alone, which is a smaller district, there's been 25. But again, it goes to show that those are the ones that have been uncovered and been found, and they've been legally exonerated, versus ones that have not been founded yet, or they're still going through the process to be legally exonerated.
And I imagine that not a whole lot of people would want to take on these sorts of cases, especially knowing the details of some of them, and I guess how long it's been since they were convicted. It just seems like it's not the success rate of it wouldn't be too high. So you would need a lot of motivation and determination to do something like this. So I admire that.
The process in Canada, it requires what they call, so if you exhaust all your appeals, you go through your provincial appeals court, and then you exhaust all your appeals, you go all the way up to the Supreme Court. After that, that's when you can apply for a 696 application, but you have to apply with fresh evidence. And this isn't something that hasn't been brought before the court ever, which makes it even more challenging to uncover fresh evidence. So for say maybe a piece of DNA that wasn't tested back when the original trial happens, and that has never been brought forward, you've come across that can be put in the 696 application. If a new witness comes forward, that you can put in a 696 application, but they're all building blocks, obviously, right? Because the Minister of Justice reviews them, makes the final call, but the Criminal Conviction Review Group at Justice Canada is the one who does the review when we send in 696 applications.
In order to get to your desk, or Innocence Ottawa's desk, it has to reach all the way up to the Supreme Court first.
Yeah, so what they have to do is exhaust all their appeals. That's how we recognize it. Basically, when innocence groups are looking at case files, it's like the last resort.
And it's a volunteer organization, right? Innocence Ottawa. Very cool, very cool. And completely shifting gear. Well, not completely, actually. Maybe we can relate it back to that at some point. Basically, this whole episode was about not law, obviously. It's about virtual dating and how it's kind of exploded now due to the whole pandemic happening around the world, how people are trying to look for ways to connect with people while they're isolated. And there's been some discussion in terms of mainstream news articles about whether this brings about more benefits than drawbacks in comparison to what we've been doing in the past, which was what I call fast food dating, or that's what I named it in the segment before this. Why I invited you here is because, well, actually, I'm super relieved that my initial idea didn't pan out. It was a terrible idea. Like, now that I think about it, basically my idea was to go on a dating platform, find somebody who would be interested in joining me on a podcast, episode and just talk about, or kind of have like a date as a podcast episode. That never would have happened. It would have been a terrible discussion, super anxiety driven. And if the person agreed to that, something messed up there, man. I don't know.
I think that just would have broken your face.
Yeah, I just feel like nothing would happen. Like, it wouldn't even be a good discussion because it's recorded. We don't know each other. And why would anybody want to listen to two people talk about themselves? I don't know. It's kind of weird. So I'm happy that when I asked you about it, you agreed to come on. And also that you use virtual dating platforms. You've used them during the pandemic and you've used them before the pandemic. So, you know, as somebody who is using these platforms now, do you notice that there are any differences in the conversations you have with the matches that you have?
I mean, honestly, I feel like people's perspectives has changed a lot during the pandemic in terms of, like, I don't know. I feel like you have like the polarity of people. You have the people that are super anxious. They're anxiety ridden. They're like thinking, oh my God, I'm now losing 2 years off my life. I need to go, 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 go. So I feel like with some people, the conversations are very driven towards like goals, future, like finding solid partnership. Whereas you have the other people that are kind of on the like YOLO end of the spectrum, where they're like, yeah, whatever, I'm just going to live my best life and continue the way I've been living. And also, too, that there's the whole mentality going around now, like, I'm over the pandemic, therefore I'm going to act and behave how I want to. So I feel like that whole polarity that we had before between long-term partnership versus like hookup culture is still present. Those two things are kind of amplified even more so now, because one of the, like I'd mentioned, people are freaking out that they should be finding long-term partnership, so therefore they're kind of pushing it more. And then on the other YOLO end with the hookup culture, there's more of a push towards like human contact, and people are feeling deprived. Let's be quite honest here. They're feeling deprived for emotional, physical intimacy. So I think there's more of a push there with those people.
Right. Okay. That's interesting that it seems that it, just based on your experience, the extremes have become more extreme, or there's less of a middle ground.
What do you think people want to get out of a casual relationship during a pandemic?
Yeah, so I guess casual in this sense would be just meeting up without any expectation. That's what I would think. I don't know. What do you think? What casual dating would be now versus before? Like casual dating before to me is like it's kind of still a hookup culture. You know, you're kind of looking for something serious too. You're okay with having one over the other. I think that was before casual dating. Now it's, you know, you want to go out because you can't go out. Obviously not be in each other's bubble, but like go out with masks.
So it's like you're seeking more just kind of like, I guess it's different for people that live alone, that they are kind of like seeking out the contact. But yeah, for me, I see casual during a pandemic as like, you basically are falling into that whole friends with benefits archetype where you're just like going over their house, chilling and hooking up. Because you're removing that kind of like
before the pandemic.
Yeah, before the pandemic, the aspect where you would maybe like go out to dinner casually or go to drinks or like go for a walk or go kayaking or whatever. You'd like you're having partnership without having commitment. And that has been removed during the pandemic. Like the somewhat normal parts of a relationship that people that wanted to have casual flings have.
And in terms of like conversation, do you think there's more substance to it? A lot of the positive articles I read said conversations have become more about obviously interests and talking about that, talking about work, but even extends beyond that in a way.
I think people are definitely like talking longer on the app before they decide if they do decide to meet up at all. I think they're kind of talking to the person to figure out what their stances are on like public health policy. Also to looking at what the public health guidelines are at the time as to like whether, you know, you can go out for a walk, a socially distanced walk with someone. Right now, obviously, none of those options are available because we're on full lockdown. But I think when we were in like phase three in Ontario, when people were looking at, you know, maybe going for a drink with someone or a walk or something socially distanced with a mask, whatever the comfort level was, drag it out longer versus now. I think, yeah, people are definitely going into like much deeper conversations because that's all they have.
I can see how people would argue that this is better. And there was a CTV news article that said that whole hookup culture is dead now. It's all about courting, which courting is a word I've never heard about in a long time.
That's such a lie. Who wrote that article? I'm sorry. Their perspective is probably subjective. It's probably an older married man.
It's different between generations, I guess.
Probably.
The experience that somebody in, I don't know, their late 30s, early 40s versus somebody our age, like close to their 30s or high 20s. Even people in their, who are just starting to use the dating apps when they're 18, 19 to 21, they're all going to have differences in how they use it. Perhaps not even changing so much pre-pandemic and now.
Oh, 100%. I feel like the people that were like 18, 19, 20 years old are like, well, this is kind of the same aside from like removing the element of meeting people in person. But I think the big thing now is to, you know, talk to someone for a really long time and add them on Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok for that generation. I feel like, yeah, that is normalcy for them. For, yeah, even people in our generation or above, yeah, this is like completely new territory.
And in terms of, we talked about the conversations that might have changed. What about the bios? To me, like as a guy who is using it, I find the bios, this may be bad, I find women's bios quite empty and boring. A lot of Instagram tags and maybe a couple of interests that I'm supposed to spark conversation with. But on Bumble, obviously the woman's supposed to spark conversation. But did you notice any differences in bios between now and before?
I mean, quite honestly, not really. I have not used like things like Tinder in over a year, thank God.
Are we going to your Tinder stories now?
Yeah, the Tinder archive. No, but like, so I think from my perspective is that with Bumble, when you have them, the filters that you can use that like display, you know, what type of partnership preference you're looking for, your do you smoke, do you drink, do you do drugs, that type of things, those type of things that you can check off on. I think in from my perspective, people use those to speak for themselves and they're going to assume that you're going to look at those and judge your opinion based on those checkboxes and their pictures versus their bio. I don't know, when I'm looking at men's profiles, they like, many of them are very empty, but the ones that like, really? Majority of the ones that put in the like effort to actually like do some type of bio that gets your attention. I don't know. For me personally, I feel like I'm more likely to swipe those than someone that has nothing.
I could be wrong, but I would imagine that women, well, they obviously see the first picture and then maybe it's a 50-50 in terms of first picture and then bio, while men, it might be like 60-40, even 80-20 in terms of picture and bio. So maybe that's why I just don't see much effort put into bios. But for you, do you find that there's like a 50-50 split in terms of the first picture and then if they have a bio in terms of whether you swipe right or left?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. I mean, if they have their like their boxes up and it's like full kind of information, and you know, they have like a decent amount of pictures that kind of display that communicate some type of like interest in an activity, like they're a skier, or a snowboarder, or an outdoors person. I think that also says a lot. But yeah, and then versus people that do have bios and like a decent amount of pictures that displays, again, interest that they have. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a split down the middle, but I think we also have to take into consideration that like studies have shown as human beings over the years, we have like our attention spans decreased a lot. So I think from a lot of people's perspective, mm-hmm. it's the apps are convenient for the swiping purposes of it. They want to be quick. They don't want to, people don't have the desire now to read through an exhaustive bio about someone. They just want kind of like a quick Coles notes and then they're going to swipe by the person. At least that's my perspective.
But yeah, I would say that because of the popularity now of these swiping platforms, these other platforms that perhaps had more substance in terms of getting to know somebody before you reach out to them has drawn less people because of this fast food sort of dating. Here's my laws and ethics question. This is where I need your expertise.
Hell yeah.
So, as someone educated in law and ethics, while having interest in psychology as well. What are your thoughts on, you know, virtual and online dating and how it has impacted us? You kind of mentioned already our decrease in attention span. Is there anything else that these dating platforms have impacted our social communication?
I feel like social accountability has definitely gone down significantly, because before, I mean, when we talk about, you know, old school dating and courtship, I feel like there was more of an onus to be completely transparent with people, to, you know, if you weren't interested, ultimately part ways, maybe in person or at least a telephone call, versus now I think social accountability has been lowered to the point of we live in an individualistic society. I'm using an app. I have a phone, a computer, a tablet between me and this person. So, you know, you can just cut ties whenever you can. There's really no consideration. I mean, this is a generalization, but I think consideration for other people's feelings has gone down significantly. So I think we're shifting towards, it's kind of funny too, though, when you're looking for partnership, yet at the end of the day, you're the one kind of using these apps just for yourself and for consideration of yourself and yourself only. So it's kind of, I don't know, it's a juxtaposition when you're looking for partnership and you kind of should have those lines of communication open, but also just on a human decency level, I think you do need to have social accountability in the sense that you shouldn't just treat people like garbage when you're communicating with them, whether they're on an app or off an app. Like in terms of messages they send, and also to the whole like ghosting phenomena, there's breadcrumbing too, I've heard of.
Breadcrumbing?
Yeah, breadcrumbing.
What's breadcrumbing?
It's basically just like when you show interest, you express interest, but not enough to push anything forward. It's kind of basically you'd give just a little bit of yourself with the expectation the person's going to hang around for you and they can swing back at any time. I don't know, in my experience, apps are giving you the availability of so many options. And people have their rosters that they operate with. So, I mean, if it doesn't work out with one person, they basically kept their options open with you. So if they want to swing back around because it doesn't work out with somebody else.
That's more common now versus, you know, when we didn't have apps and you just kind of gave your cell phone number or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, it just like goes down to like respect for people. I think the level of respect that people have for each other has gone down. I mean, many people have positive experiences. Research studies of sample groups has shown that there are people that have had a significant amount of negative experiences.
Right. Like, I guess the negativity of that a woman would experience would be different than the negativity that a man would experience.
Yeah.
How do you feel about people that use these sorts of things as a way to boost their confidence?
Oh, God. Like, come on, brah. Just become an Instagram model, okay?
A reaction.
When we're talking about terms of usage, like, I don't want to get into that too much and be a Karen about it. But, I mean, when you're using it to...
Oh, please.
When you're using it for those purposes because you need, you know, the ego stroke, the inflation boost, the validation. I mean, at the end of the day, it boils down to, like, you're using a dating app, so, like, use it for those purposes. I'm pretty sure... I mean, Bumble has Bumble Business, so, yo, if you want to hype your Instagram account, just use Bumble Business.
I guess so. I don't know anybody who uses the other two functions of it.
Neither do I, but I'm just throwing it out there.
Actually, I read there was a Reddit post recently on the Bumble subreddit. A woman was complaining. It was interesting. She said she felt how a man felt on Bumble BFF because she would never get responses back or many matches while she was using it. And she would be talking to women and guys. And she would get ghosted or just it would end up leading to nothing.
When you do use apps, you are kind of signing up for the mentality that like it's a numbers game. So, I mean, if it doesn't work out with one person, I feel like you do unfortunately need to develop, I don't want to say tough skin, but like, you know, just move on to the next.
Kind of in regards to that and how we kind of use these like social media, somewhat related though, and how we kind of use them as an ego booster. But I've discussed with other people the benefits and drawbacks of some sort of rating system. So hear me out, hear me out. I know there's a Black Mirror episode where it went really downhill when they implemented a rating system for life in general. But in terms of an app, I think it could be beneficial for people to know like what they need to do to make them appeal to people that they are attracted to. That's why I think some dating app, I don't know how it could be implemented properly. I'll have to think about it a bit more.
Are you saying that
there was some dating app that uses a rating system
for you yourself so you can alter your profile to appeal better?
Yeah, so it helps you appeal better to the people you are attracted to. Like you can use these dating apps kind of as like a self-development.
Well, you know that psychological theory, or it's more of a psychology, sociology theory, where it's like the looking glass self. How other people see you is how you see yourself, and you manage your behaviors and characteristics based on what other people you're reading from other people.
I don't know that theory, but that makes sense.
But I feel like that's kind of like what you're alluding to when you say the rating system for self-improvement. I think based off like of your interactions with other people or your feedback for your rating, you're going to kind of like, you know, modify and alter maybe how you present yourself on your profile. But at the end of the day, I mean, would that be so useful in terms of like, I feel like there's just so many things that could go wrong with that. Just like... No, but like, you know, from a mental health perspective, I mean, if a rating system comes to play, people get like bad negative ratings, how would you implement and monitor that? Because I mean, people are already kind of like trolls on dating apps for people. I know there was an introduction of something recently into Bumble's terms of use based on women's feedback about body shaming. They had like, I think that's considered a violation of terms of use now, so you can get bumped off the app. So I feel like if you implemented a rating system, there would need to be like, not necessarily need, I think there'd be, where's the line for that between self-improvement and the way that I think you're interpreting it versus like changing yourself based on negative feedback, which you use an app to be your authentic self, to find partnership by being your authentic self.
Yeah, so I guess what you're saying is you wouldn't need some sort of metric to like achieve the goal that you pursue in these apps.
No, I feel like there's baseline. I feel like I was reading an article from a PhD student in California, and they now work for Bumble, and they have like suggestions about how you can improve your profile. But it's things like, you know, having this many profile pictures on your profile, to smile in some of your pictures, more like general feedback things versus like pointed, directed things that would be coming to individuals. I mean, I feel like the rating system would just end up blowing up in their face.
I just wish there was some sort of way, not just myself, but people that are not like achieving what they want to achieve on these apps, a way that they could like learn how to go about doing that, you know, other than reading general tips and tricks. Like, for example, if I were to post a certain amount of pictures, different kinds of pictures, and then only some pictures would get rated better than others, for example. And I think there is an app that allows you to like certain photos on someone's profile. That is kind of a metric to tell you which photo
Hinge
or photos are good. Hinge, yeah, I think so.
Hinge uses that. I mean, that's like that's a better metric, I think. Though I have had like feedback from friends saying that they've like received nasty messages from people over their photos, like you appear really stuck up, things like that, like negative type feedback. And at the end of the day, it goes back to the thing you learn in kindergarten. I mean, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all. I mean, if you're not interested in the person, just swipe past them. I mean, you're never going to eliminate the nasty people in general. I think there's always going to be the likelihood with anything, especially online, and the accessibility that people
on the internet.
Eliminate nastiness.
We'll kind of relate to now what we both do. So we're both in academia doing graduate school. And I don't think there's enough discussion on the dating life of academics. I feel like there's a misconception or stereotype, you know, when you're at a certain age or when you get into like higher level education, there's some sort of misconception that you know, you're with us, you're with somebody, with a partner, something like that. Other than time constraints, obviously, for going on dates, are there negativities for single people in academia?
At the end of the day, when you're an MA student or a PhD student or any type of graduate student or doing like any type of advanced technical degree, you're basically married to your topic. And people aren't always going to understand that you are committing to this as almost like a full-time job. And there's a lot of misunderstandings from that. Just again, like you said, I mean, time constraints are a huge issue. You know, you're working full-time on your research. You're going to prioritize things outside of that based on obviously your values. And for me personally, I mean, yeah, dating is an important aspect of life if you want a partner for long term, but family comes first, friends come first, my mental health comes first, physical activity comes first. So like, I don't know, dating for me kind of goes at the very bottom. There.
I like your honesty.
Yeah, but people just don't understand that you're married to your topic, and if it's something that they're not necessarily interested in, that's a huge strain. I mean, I've been in situations that where you're trying to vent to a partner, and they just like, okay, you're writing a paper. That's kind of like the perception of it. You're writing a paper. Get over it. Or they don't really take a genuine interest in what you're doing for your research. Is that a good partner? No. But that's like the commonality that I have encountered, is that people just like don't take an interest in what you're doing. And then from there, I mean, because your life is all about your thesis. And if someone doesn't take an interest in it, then...
I feel that people outside of academia argue that perhaps you shouldn't dedicate so much time to something like your thesis or work in general. Like when people say, oh, I'm working too much, not in academia, that's considered a bad thing, right? Yeah. I would say like majority of the time that's considered a bad thing. But when somebody says I'm dedicating my time to my education, to my thesis, there's some gray area there when it's kind of the same thing, right?
I mean, it is. Again, it goes back to being a full-time job. I remember in my first year of my master's, one of my research professors, literally at the very beginning of class, she's like, this is going to be time-consuming, it's going to be mentally exhausting, it's going to be challenging. And she said, realistically, people in your personal life are not going to understand. She said, your family's not going to understand sometimes, your extended family, your partners, your friends.
This is a good ad for higher education.
She laid the law down. She basically said, congratulations, yeah, you're not going to have a life for the next 2 years.
Your perception, do you think that's the right mindset to have going into graduate studies? Or maybe it should change so that, you know, you should have time to have more of a social life?
I feel like it goes back to the whole debate that's always prevalent, the whole like work-life balance. I think particularly for graduate students, having like a good support system behind you and having people to kind of vent to that are always going to be there, that are more understanding. And like, I don't know, I feel like keeping your circle smaller in grad school definitely was way more beneficial than like trying to keep in contact with a whole bunch of people, because people at the end of the day get frustrated when you're limited on time.
I almost found that it became smaller automatically. You didn't invest time in people that you wouldn't consider as close to your inner circle, but maybe in the moment you didn't know that they weren't in your close inner circle. Maybe you thought they were, and then now you realize, oh, I haven't talked to this person in over a year now, and they haven't reached out to me either, so what the hell.
It's with any relationship in your life ever, whether it's romantic or platonic, you want the relationship to be based on reciprocity. You support them, they support me. And you look for those types of relationships when you're going through grad school. Yeah, it can't be a one-way street. And at the end of the day, when in terms of dating, anyone that has had that mentality, oh, you can ditch it for the weekend, you don't need to write that, oh, you need to relax at the expense of your work, is that a good partner long-term? Probably not. You want to look for someone that's understanding. And then, again, it's reciprocity. They're understanding, I'm going to be understanding.
Okay, so now we're on the fun question.
Hell yeah.
And I sent this to Eilish beforehand, so I'm curious about her answer. As somebody who uses these apps, as am I, knowing full well what these apps are doing to us, what feature would you implement that apps currently don't have?
This is going to be such a cop-out answer, but me personally, like, I would just eliminate them totally and go back to the way that things used to be. Because at the end of the day, though, you have to think about... Think about in the sense that all applications that we use are, they're facilitators. They're not actually doing anything aside from giving you matches versus through algorithms. So they're facilitators, they're platforms that you as a human being have to operate and interact with. I think at the end of the day, regardless if you change anything on the current situation with applications, it's not going to alter the way that humans behave with each other through these apps, if that makes sense. Because even if you had a filter that, like, oh yeah, okay, if you're talking about a rating system, how about if we use the Uber or the Uber Eats rating system where the person got a star rating? So after you went out on a date with someone, you gave them a star rating. And the person ends up with a crap star rating. I mean, even if the person has a crap star rating, I feel like, and the rating doesn't really do anything. They're still, I don't want to say they're a trash human being, but like, this is still
an... I tried to hold that in.
I just sound like a jaded person, but you know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like at the end of the day, it's all about the person. I mean, even if you implemented some type of filtration system, they're still going to be talking to people, they're still going to be interacting, and they're still going to be behaving in the way that they probably were all along. It's not going to change them at all.
You think the drawbacks of these platforms outweigh the benefits? Because I think the benefits would be that you potentially have some idea of this person before you interact with them, versus in, you know, when these apps didn't exist, you're kind of just shooting in the dark because you're just attracted to their physical characteristics.
Yeah, but I mean, that's like kind of taking out of the context if you meet someone at a bar. What if you go back to the times where you meet someone through a friend, which apparently there are American studies, but like American studies are demonstrating that even those types of matchmaking situations based on, you know, maybe getting a blind date from a friend that's setting you up, or like a colleague or something, those are proven to have gone down versus...
For sure.
Yeah, so I mean... See, those are the situations. Okay. Even work situations. I know it's like, you know, taboo, but those situations do happen. So I feel like going back to the days where, you know, you do meet people through friends, you meet them through recreational sports teams, through work, through other social things that you may do, through university, undergrad, master's, PhD programs. Even your parents setting you up with, like, their friend's child, you know, those types of situations. I would never, ever want that at all. But I'm just saying, like, I don't know. I feel like the toning down with apps, there's definitely a reliance, an over-reliance on app these days. I think there are positives, like, you know, maybe talking to people that you wouldn't normally interact with. Like, that's a benefit. Someone that, like, has a lot of the same values, interests as you, that you wouldn't normally interact with. That's a positive. But I feel like in a sense that some of the harmful behaviors that go on using apps, like, those should be eliminated. And I don't think there's really a way to filter that type of stuff out.
How about the increase in virtual dates, having a video chat beforehand now? Do you think that's been more beneficial?
I mean, I feel like that's going to... Again, studies are showing that people... are probably going to, even post-pandemic, swing maybe towards...
Continue doing that.
Swing towards having virtual dates before they meet up with someone. But no, I definitely... I don't know, from that perspective too, I would say that. People in conversations with friends that, like, are actually, you know, meeting up with people, the fact that you're doing it in, like, a socially distanced way, it kind of removes any type of, like, eventual or romantic aspect to it. It's more of like a platonic meetup. So I think there's a lot at loss for that, just because it's like, oh, I'm just kind of meeting up with a friend. There's no like any type of romantic sparks because we have to be 6 feet away.
So that's all the questions I had for old Eilish here. So normally I just end these with some final thoughts on what we discussed in terms of pandemic dating, in terms of how these apps have completely messed our brains, and in terms of promoting groups that you are a part of.
Sorry, you're frozen. Final thoughts. Sorry. We swayed a lot to the negative. I don't want to really go like too far to the negative. You know, that's for like an after hours show when we deep dive into the Tinder archives. But we need that deep saxophone music. But I mean, do what's functional to you in terms of using apps, not using apps. Do what you're comfortable with, what is accessible to you at the time. People should be able to do what they want in terms of dating, judgment free. And as I say, like I've heard of people that have had very, very positive experiences. I know that like my sister has friends that met off Tinder that are now engaged, and you know, they've had completely great partnerships. So I don't want to be like negative Nelly again, Karen, about things. So you do you. We'll use that classic line. In terms of plugs, if you want to check out Innocence Ottawa, you can find us at www.innocenceottawa.ca. We also have a Facebook page at Innocence Ottawa and an Instagram at Innocence Ottawa. And right now, we are a completely volunteer-based operation. And during the pandemic, we're actually selling masks. So if you are interested in buying a mask for $10 to support the cause, all proceeds do go to the work that we do. Please direct message us on Instagram or Facebook.
What's the mask look like?
So it's a plain black mask, and it has our insignia on the side. So it's not like crazy where you have like, you know, a huge insignia on the middle of your face that you clearly are doing targeted advertisement for something. There's our insignia on the side of it. I already put you down for like 10 masks, okay, so it's okay.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks for doing this. Again, definitely better than my first idea. I think we had a lot to discuss, and I think it went well.
Peace out.
I will I'll try and have you for a more real conversation about legal matters, maybe.
Yeah, I'll actually have tequila that time. But yeah, no, that'd be a good thing to discuss. Legal beagle.
Legal beagle. Let's end on Legal Beagle.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Metaforigens podcast. As another update, I've established a place in Dublin, only a 30-40 minute walk from Trinity, and big enough for my pet cat Mila to roam around. Once decorated, pics of my setup will be posted on the Instagram page. Further updates will be given via bits and pieces throughout the season, so stay tuned and hope you enjoy the ride. Remember to follow the Instagram page for these visual updates, as well as to be entered into the draw for the custom butterfly-printed Metaforigen shirt, which will be given out on the 30th episode. Until then, stay skeptical, but curious.